Hi there. Thank you for allowing me to be a part of your journey today. I am your host, K-Town, and you're listening to Mysterious Radio. My special guest tonight says there are so many Christians teaching outrageous speculation about end times Bible prophecy. It's enough to frustrate the serious Bible student. What if you found out most of it is simply mistaken? What if you found out that everything that modern prophecy pundits are looking for, the rapture, the tribulation, the Antichrist, the beast, was not what they told you it was, but something different? Brian's book, End Times Bible Prophecy, Is Not What They Told You, Chronicles of the Apocalypse, he says, will answer all those questions. And you can get your copy right now on Amazon, in Kindle, audiobook, and paperback. And now, here's my special guest, Brian Godawa.
Well, I'm an author and a screenwriter, and I've been screenwriting for quite a few decades, and in more recent years, I've sort of focused on writing novels more and doing more movies on the side, so I'm still writing movies, but basically, I'm a storyteller, and I started out as a screenwriter because I loved movies. I've always loved movies. You know, they really move me and they really impact me. But as a Christian, when I was growing up, particularly when I got into college, and I began to study the arts, and I had a hard time understanding how my faith interacted with creativity and art. And I basically came up as a Christian in a basic evangelical, sort of non-denominational in a way, background. So that was, you know, his basic evangelical background and stuff. But it was a hard thing for me to understand creativity and how that applies to my faith. And I struggled because a lot of people who aren't artists don't understand that world. It's kind of we live in a weird world, artists. You know, we're seeing things differently. We're always, you know, our minds are sort of going off into air. Places that other people don't think, because that's kind of how we are. That's what we do. We create and stuff. And, you know, I always had a sort of a, not a shame, but it was definitely like a, you know, the church didn't understand me, you know? And so I was struggling in that point in time, and I began to see how the power of movies and how mostly the power of movies for the bad. You know, I would see movies that I could see the messages in them being detrimental. And I wanted to be able to tell stories like that, but orient them towards God or towards the truth in a way. And that's what inspired me years ago to start doing it. But I studied screenwriting on my own because I already was going in a direction for a job, and I didn't want to be a starving artist at first. I continued and pursued my normal career, got married. And then I started, studying screenwriting on my own and trying to break in. And then, so over the years, I eventually broke in about 2000 or so with my movie To End All Wars, starring Kiefer Sutherland. And I'm very proud of that movie. And it's free now, actually, right now on YouTube. And I think it's also free on Amazon. But anyway, that launched my career as a professional and expert storyteller. And I've also written a book to help other Christians and other religious people to try to understand storytelling in movies better, called Hollywood Worldviews. And that was my attempt to try to help the church understand movies better, and not just throw the baby out with the bathwater, you know, because I think that the church often does that. They, you know, there's a reaction, you know, you see the sex and violence, which there is too much of it, obviously, in movies, but then they'll just throw the whole baby out with the bathwater, and they won't recognize that there are a lot of good movies. And movies, like everything in life, are a mixed bag. So that was my goal, to try to do that. But as I grew in my faith and in my understanding and creativity and storytelling, I got to the point where quite a few years ago, I started writing novels, and I began with Chronicles of the Nephilim. And basically what it was as I studied the Bible and theological concepts, I kind of stumbled onto this amazing thread, storyline in the Bible that's there. It's not hidden, but we don't see it because we have these modern Western eyes. And the more that I sought to understand the ancient Near Eastern context of the Bible, it kind of, I began to see things I didn't see before. Michael Heiser was a scholar who's written a book called The Unseen Realm that was very influential on me. And basically, I saw a powerful imaginative thread throughout the Bible that reinforced the notion of Messiah, but it sort of added new elements to it. And dealing with some of these strange passages we read, like, you know, Genesis 6, where it talks about the sons of God coming down to earth, mating with the daughters of men and bearing them giants called Nephilim, you know. So that my whole series, Chronicles of Nephilim, was an attempt to try to make sense of that storyline, retell Bible stories that will illuminate that theological thread for people. And it's kind of like reading Lord of the Rings meets the Bible, you know, because I'm trying to show the spiritual world what that might look like, the unseen realm as it interacts with history. Now, that was a series that ended up being like 8 books, and I got to near the end of it where I was telling the story of Jesus in this context, and I realized I had one more series to go, and that was Chronicles of the Apocalypse. And that's kind of the story that I think we're going to focus a little bit on today is that, so as a Christian, I've seen it all.
Stop right there. I want you to stop right there. So I know you're going to go into something good. It's going to take you off somewhere else. And I don't want to, because you said a lot that's very interesting. And I want to get this out because you're a screenwriter. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to pick your brain here a little bit. You know, we've seen a lot of movies being released around end time events. I want to know from your perspective before we move on, are these movies being produced on purpose to influence future events, maybe, or the public's thinking in some way, in your opinion?
Well, that's a good question, because that is the next thing I want to kind of get into. Where to begin? When I was a young Christian, we're talking back in the 70s, late 70s, Hal Lindsey was the big – he wrote this book called The Late Great Planet Earth, and it was one of the first – it wasn't the first time, but it was one of the most influential books of the decade. I mean, he sold, I don't know, something like 30 million books or so. It was unbelievable. It was unprecedented. And it was all about the end of the world. It was all about the end times and how the Bible relates to it. And the reason why he wrote that was because a lot of Christians believe that there are several different sort of systems of beliefs in the end times. And the dominant one that most of us are familiar with today that we've been exposed to is what I would call dispensationalism or maybe premillennialism. And that's sort of the belief that Christ will return in a distant future or in our near future. And then, but before he does, there will be a rapture of all the Christians off the earth, and then there will be a 7-year tribulation, and an antichrist will rise up. Now, these things I'm saying are very familiar with most people, but not in my day they weren't. And I remember that I saw like the first Christian movie about the rapture and the end times was this, you know, really, you look at it now, it's really bad, but it was called A Thief in the Night, and that was that's become a classic. And it was basically just they were trying to say how what the new world order is going to look like with the Antichrist in control before Christ returns and all this stuff. And I think it was rooted in this belief that we are the last generation before this end of the world thing, you know, happening. And it's rooted in the belief that Israel, the nation, the geopolitical nation that we know now, the contemporary nation of Israel, is still sort of focused in Bible prophecy. And so they believe that their interpretation of some passages in the Bible were that when Israel becomes a nation, within one generation, you'll see all these things take place. And so Israel became a nation around 1948. So 40 years is 1988. So around that time period of the late 70s, early 80s, and into the 80s, I think it began this explosion of the, you know, this is it, man, because a generation, Jesus said, all these things will occur within one generation in Matthew 24, right? And so they were assuming that it was referencing that notion of, you know, of Israel becoming a nation. And so that's where the fervor was really reached a pitch. And well, you know, 1988 came and went and nothing happened. And then 1998, 10 years more, another 10 years, 2008, another 10 years, 2018. That belief system is in the process of dying. And the interesting thing is it's still basically the dominant belief system. Most people will have heard of Left Behind, right? That was the book series that came out. I don't know. I think that was the 90s.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and that was of course, you know, tens of millions of books and, you know, that were sold. And of course, movies have been made, even one, a remake of Left Behind with Nicolas Cage in it, right? And that the premise was there's going to be a rapture, you know, it's going to surprise us out of nowhere and the Christians will disappear and all this. And so that whether or not people believe that, that's sort of the most influential view, and certainly in the media. And I think that, you know, and a lot of that is also rooted in, you see a lot of ministries now with the explosion of YouTube and such, and you know, just in the internet, a lot of end times ministries. There's a lot of money in it. And I think that's because it's sensational. It's exciting. It's like, hey, we might be the last generation. We'll see all these wild, crazy things. You know, the Lord's going to rescue us. But ultimately, it's this sort of belief that we're special. We want to be really special to God. But the problem is that, you know, if you look back through history, you know, and it goes back more than just the last 50 years. It goes, you know, thousands of years where people kept predicting the Christ is coming. We're the last generation. You know, Mussolini's the Antichrist. Hitler's the Antichrist. Gorbachev's the Antichrist. You know, and so every 5 or 10 years, these people change their views. And I think that was one of the biggest things that began to affect me and change my mind about this issue of the end times. I sort of went along with the usual belief. It made sense. It was kind of cool. And but what I started seeing, well, you know, these things aren't happening like they're saying. And they're so sure of them. Like, oh, you know, they have their Bible verses that they think this is where it's fulfilled in the newspapers and all this. But yet every 5 or 10 years, it changes, you know. It's like first is Russia is the focus of all these prophecies. And then it's Islam. And now it's China. And they just keep changing. And they're always wrong. That started to nag at me. And I think that now that we're two generations past that time period where they thought things were going to happen, more people are starting to wise up and realize, yeah, these things aren't happening the way they said, and they keep changing it, and they're wrong all the time. Literally, look through history. You know, there's a book by Francis Gummerlach called The Day and the Hour, and he chronicles some of these through history, how these Christians have predicted, oh, these are the fulfillment of prophecies, and they're not. And this is not to say that I'm not here to say that the Bible's wrong. I'm saying the way Christians are interpreting this is it may be completely off. Maybe there are different ways of seeing this. And, you know, many years ago that happened to me. And I started looking into other viewpoints that were within the realm of Christian orthodoxy. There are multiple viewpoints. And I began to read scholarly authors that began to sort of show how a lot of Bible prophecy is misunderstood by Christians because they'll read it within our modern mindset rather than in the ancient mindset to the people to whom it was written. So, for example, you go back to Matthew 24, where I said, you know, that the people think, oh, Jesus said within a generation of Israel becoming a nation, all these things are going to happen, right? If you go back there and you do a study on, I did this intense study on Matthew 24, the Olivet Discourse, and it turns out that all those factors in that passage can be shown to have occurred in the first century up until the destruction of the temple and Jerusalem in AD 70. And when I first heard that, it shocked me. I'm like, what? That's heresy, you know? But as I studied it and looked into history and found these connections and realizing some of this language that I had misinterpreted as scientific language is actually very poetic language. So, for example, like I was getting to, you know, in that passage where Jesus says, truly I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. All these things will happen to this generation. And then he says, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you killed the prophets, but I tell you, you know, your house is being left to you desolate, which means the house was God's temple, and he's going to desolate the temple. So Jesus was saying, you see all this temple and these buildings, truly not one stone will be left upon another. Most scholars do acknowledge that that's a reference to the destruction of the temple in AD 70. But because of the rest of the language, they automatically interpret this prophetic language as if it's literal, right? So they'll read things like, you know, the great tribulation will occur. If you look down in Matthew 24 and you see verse 29, immediately after the tribulation, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man. So, you know, that language is like, oh, that's got to be scientific because, you know, that's how we think and that's how we might write. But these Bible scholars were helping me to say, whenever you're seeing prophetic language, there's always a precedent in the Old Testament, particularly if you're reading it in the New Testament. This language was used by prophets a lot in the Old Testament. And when you go back and you read those passages, you find that there's many of them, by the way. This isn't just one or two cases. There's many cases. And when they describe this cosmic collapse, for instance, and the stars falling from the sky rolling up like a scroll, these are used as poetic symbols that refer to the fall of earthly and heavenly powers. So, for instance, you know, when Babylon was destroyed by the Medes in 537 BC. Isaiah wrote in chapter 13, the stars of the heavens and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be dark. The moon will not shed its light. I will punish the land for its evil, etc. And that passage is a judgment against, you got to study it, you know, you can't just take it on the surface, but it's a judgment against Babylon. Well, did the stars fall from the sky in 537 BC? Did the sun? No. And there's many cases of that throughout the Bible that language is used to events that occurred in the past, and they always are in reference to God judging a nation, a tribe, or a city, and he uses that language. Why? Because it describes the spiritual significance of it. And the earthly, you know, God judging an earthly, you know, nation or an earthly city like Babylon or Edom or Egypt, and actually the language is also used when the temple was destroyed in 586 BC. You know, the first temple of Israel had been destroyed, and the same language was used of that destruction. The sky rolled up like a scroll, the stars falling. And so we see that stuff didn't happen back then, but that was poetic language describing the fall of earthly powers. And because they also believe the heavenly powers were behind the earthly powers, you use the language of the heavenly, you know, objects falling from the sky. So that was just one little example of many throughout the prophetic text that started to change my mind in understanding what prophecy means and understanding the symbolism behind it, and that maybe all these end time scenarios that we now see, you know, which really look more like Marvel movies or science fiction Marvel movies, right? That the prophecies use symbolic language to refer to actual historical judgments upon nations or peoples. And so going back to Matthew 24, you can see, you know, and I wrote a book on this where I went through the whole chapter of Matthew 24. The book's called End Times Bible Prophecy. You can get it on Amazon. But I went through it and showed how all those verses refer to what Jesus had said, which was the destruction of the temple. He said it in the very beginning. But because people see the rest of the language, it reads like it seems so much more scientifically, extreme that couldn't have happened. But you find that, no, it's symbolic, and it does all refer to that destruction of the temple in AD 70. And the reason why that was so important and why that is the meaning of the most of the prophecy people are thinking refers to our future, it refers to the past and that destruction of the temple, was because the temple was an incarnation of the old covenant. And when Jesus came, when Messiah came, he brought the new covenant, and the old covenant was done away with. But the problem was, we knew that was occurring spiritually and in heaven, right? Jesus was ascended to the right hand of God on the throne in heaven, but on earth, that old covenant thing was still there. It was like a carcass. And so God marked historically and publicly the end of the old covenant by having the Romans destroy it. And that was that public historic, expression of the new covenant truth, that the new covenant had come and done away with the old covenant, as well as the fact that, going back to that passage about Jesus saying, this generation, all these things will come upon this generation. Whenever Jesus uses that terminology, this generation, in the Gospels, look it up, because every case he's talking about the Jews of the first century who rejected Jesus as Messiah. And so this generation was a derogatory term of judgment. You are going to be judged. Why? Because you rejected and killed Messiah. Now, this is not to say that all Jews after that are guilty of killing Messiah. No, it's just that first generation that Jesus was saying, you're going to kill me, and God's going to judge you because of it by destroying the temple. And so there's this element of judgment and atonement that are linked in this notion of the end of the age. And so the end of the age is not what we think of it as, the end of time and space, but it's the end of the old covenant age. That's the context of the meaning of that. The old covenant age was done away with because the new covenant age had arrived. So that's a real quick summary of what I think a lot of the Bible prophecy in the New Testament is pointing to, is the first century arrival of the new covenant and the doing away of the old covenant and the judging of the old covenant people who had rejected Messiah. Whereas many Christians these days misread a lot of this as something in our future. And so that, I know that's shocking, most people are now starting to hear more about this, because of the fact that I said, the prophecy pundits and speculators have been proven wrong so long, and we're getting so far away from that initial fulfillment time frame that they gave us, that people are saying, yeah, maybe I should consider another way of interpreting prophecy, because the typical way of the future end times is wrong. They're wrong over and over again.
Yeah, I have to jump in here real quick.
Sure. Sorry to keep. I talk so fast. You gotta butt in.
No, don't worry about it. Totally
just
fine.
Right in. I need to shut up.
No, you're fine. Yeah, you said a lot of really good stuff here. Okay, so I want to go back, because you talked about how, people are, they are interpreting the end times in many different ways. They hear about it from one person. It sounds very different when it comes from someone else. But I want to go back and ask you your opinion, because you mentioned like the Nephilim and things like that. You discovered that, I guess, in church when you were younger. But, you talk to people about it and they're like, I've never heard it ever once in my church. So for some reason, the church leaders, they're not even concentrating on that part of the Bible. Maybe they're not talking about it at all. I don't know. Kind of like they're picking and choosing what to actually speak to their congregation about. So why do you think, the average person who may have went to church all their life, they don't even know what a Nephilim is. They haven't heard of it. Why do you think, or do you think that is an issue at all in church? They're not being fully taught what this part of the Bible means, even Genesis 6, for that matter.
Yeah, I think there's one of the things I want to do is I don't want to impute bad motives, or I don't want to think the worst of people. So I try to give the best, because I think of myself when I was in that, you know, like I just learned this about, I don't know, maybe 14, 15 years ago is when I first started to learn it. And I didn't learn it in church either, actually. I did it because I love researching the Bible on my own. Not everybody has the time or interest in doing that. And I think that churches often, and particularly, you know, again, I'm from the evangelical persuasion, so I'm not a Catholic, or, you know, I'm not in that world, but from within my dominant world that does have this, you know, these views of the end times and all that, and as well as not understanding the Nephilim as much, I do believe that the leadership, you know, the shepherds tend to see their responsibility of shepherding those beneath them, you know, as guiding them into, you know, moral behavior, good lives, loving one another, all good stuff. But they tend to shy away from controversial stuff, or from too deep of material, or from stuff that is weird. And over the years, I just had to become honest with myself. And I actually think there's a renaissance of Christians who are becoming more honest with the fact that there's a lot of weird stuff in the Bible. And we just kind of look over it and just keep going, because there's, you know, there's so much in the Bible. When I read that chapter in, you know, in Genesis 6, you know, there are giants on the earth in those days called Nephilim and all this stuff, I would just go, what is that? I don't know. I'll just keep reading. Oh, Goliath was a giant. That's okay. But this stuff is weird and it doesn't make sense, and so I just keep going. And I think that sometimes the church leadership is afraid that some of this weird stuff might cause Christians to get off into goofy, you know, sidetracking, or which, by the way, it does happen. Or, you know, they'll become liberal because they'll see weird things in the Bible, and a lot of times the liberals are seizing on those weird things to try to discredit the Bible. But what I see happening is there's a whole sort of new generation of Christians who aren't afraid to say, there's weird stuff in here and it doesn't make a lot of sense, but I want to understand it. And I'm willing to accept the Bible on its own terms rather than trying to protect it, you know? I think a lot of shepherds try to protect the Bible. If we start talking about giants and angels mating with human beings, I mean, that's what Genesis 6 says, right? But if we start talking about that, that's crazy. That's going to make people think it's mythological. You know what I mean? Like, it's got that sense to it. But I think that, you know, a new generation, people aren't afraid to address that and think in terms of, well, but what did they mean when they wrote it? And how did they see the world? And maybe, you know, maybe the Bible isn't speaking in modern day scientific language like we're used to anyway. So I do think that there's a real openness to it. But I do think that a lot of times it's the protective nature that leaders are trying to protect their people, but they don't realize is they're actually doing them a disservice, because eventually they're going to have to face that. And then if they face it and they don't know how to deal with it, it could hurt their faith, you know? So
you're right.
Yeah, I think that that's sort of the what's going on there. But I do have a lot of hope. Like I say, you know, here's the thing though. So there is a large interest in Nephilim now, because there's a lot of people who – but like I say, I think we live in a sci-fi age where people love imagination and fantasy, and they prefer it to reality sometimes, right? I write fantasy. I love it. But I think people like to escape reality too much sometimes, and so they're willing to sort of, you know, discover these weird things in the Bible and just go all the way to the extreme. And, you know, and I think that we have examples of that now too, where it's people are going a little bit too far with it. And I don't think that I don't necessarily agree with all that they're doing. So it's a tender balance of when you're facing the controversial or weird things in the Bible, you have to be careful and, you know, I guess just seek to study it thoroughly and not just accept whatever sensational preacher is out there. Because that's the other thing, you know, we have this tendency of people who are charismatic preachers. I don't mean that theologically. I just mean personality-wise, they're charismatic personalities, and they're very, you know, very, very gifted maybe, you know, with persuasion or storytelling, whatever, you know, they get these ministries and lots of people following them, and they're great storytellers. And they can influence a lot of people. And I think that sometimes they can influence them for the bad because so many Christians so easily follow things. So my goal is just to study, to show yourself approved, consider what people are saying, but also look at opposing viewpoints. And that's what I've often done. And that's why I've ended up where I am now, where, you know, I'm now I'm more the outsider saying, you know, hey, you know, I know everybody loves, I like to call it the left behind view, because that's the one thing that it's easy to remember, you know, the left behind view of the end times. You know, it's been wrong so many times, and it's going to be wrong again. So consider seeing things in a different way. So what I did as a professional storyteller was I wanted to incarnate that view into novels. And I wanted, not because I was mimicking Left Behind, I wasn't. I just felt like this had not been done. My viewpoint had not been done. And there's an explosion of books, for example, novels, because of Left Behind. There's a lot of novels about the end times now. And like I say, a lot of them are fun fantasy sci-fi stuff. But nobody's really written a book about the origin story of the book of Revelation. They're writing all these books about how they think Revelation applies to our future. But I wanted to write, well, what was the origin of the book of Revelation? And then how did that first century of Christians, how did they understand the book of Revelation as applying to them? And so that's what I wrote my series called Chronicles of the Apocalypse. Gotcha. And the first book.
And that's available on Amazon and your website.
And that's available on Amazon in audiobook as well as paperback and ebook. All my stuff is exclusively on Amazon. And so that's a four novel series. And what I tried to do was, like I say, you know, I don't know your audience. There's a wide diversity of people in the way that they approach their faith. I know that there are a lot of people who love digging into theology and the Bible study. Then there's a lot of people who don't, or a lot of people who have a hard time understanding, you know, the heavy stuff. So what I want to do is I do all that heavy research and I love it. But then I put it into a simplified story that sort of shows dramatically in the context of humans and their story, our lives, dramatic stories like movies, you know, and I try to incarnate that view so that you can learn about the theology, but do so within a dramatic, entertaining context. And that's what Chronicles of the Apocalypse is. It literally, I'm telling the story of the first century when the book of Revelation was written by John. So you've got Nero and the great fires of Rome and how Nero persecuted the Christians. And then...
Hold on 1 second. But Brian, aren't you... you really still are doing what others are doing, and you're putting your own interpretation on it. And so when people, you know, they get confused and they don't know what to believe or how to think about it, because you see it as one way and then they'll go talk to someone else, a leader of their church, and they see it another way. So how do you suggest that they come to any kind of conclusion as to what to believe, really?
Well, I think that that's the story of all of life. You know, you just, there are going to be opposing viewpoints about everything, even within Christianity, even within, you know, look at all the denominations, right? And I would just say, well, listen to both sides, you know, because that's what I did. I went and read books by both sides. And, you know, here's the thing. I definitely believe that the Bible says God is gifted in the church, some people with the gift of teaching, evangelism, et cetera, et cetera. Teaching is one of those gifts where some people like me who goes more in depth in the research, all right, and God uses the interaction of different viewpoints to try to hone and sharpen us so that we become tolerant of one another, gracious with one another, but also sharpening our viewpoints. Because like I said, we're humans, we're not God. So we're going to be wrong about a lot of things, even theology and even our views about God. You know, I mean, it took a while for the church to get their understanding of the deity of Christ, right? They had to argue over it. And some people had different views. So that's all normal and good, actually. It's just a matter of, you know, you don't just listen to one voice and don't just listen to my voice. You know, I don't care, you know, listen to multiple voices. But I would say seek to understand the scriptures as much in context with other scriptures as possible, rather than comparing it to the newspaper or something like that. At least the foremost sort of rule of interpreting the Bible is what we call interpreting scripture with scripture. In other words, if there's something in the Bible that you want to understand, try and find it in other places in the Bible and see if you can gain some understanding from these other contexts to bring to the context you're trying to understand. And so those, you know, the viewpoint that that affected me the most was the viewpoint that referred the most to scripture. And that's one of the reasons why I think I was probably, you know, drawn to it, because they did, you know, a lot of scripture. Like, just the example I gave you was just one example of hundreds and hundreds of examples where, you know, what does the abomination of desolation mean? You know, well, it actually occurred in the Old Testament in multiple cases. Let's go there and find out and see if it can shed light on it. What does the great tribulation mean? That kind of a thing. So I just think it's up to each of us to, you know, like the Bible says, you know, the check what you read. Check what the preacher's telling you or the storyteller's telling you. Check it against the scriptures as best you can. But so I, in other words, I think this is all a, you know, because we have a diversity of viewpoints within the body of Christ, I think that it's a good thing that we have all these different viewpoints and we're challenging one another to sharpen them, because I've changed my mind over time about many things. I've had differing interpretations, and the only way that I grew was I listened to other viewpoints, and some of those viewpoints I said, you know what, that proves that has a better proof of that viewpoint than this other viewpoint, right? So that's what I hope I can do. So let me tell you this, here's what I did. Because I'm oriented that way, when I wrote my novels, Chronicles of the Apocalypse, I actually footnoted the novels so that you can read the story as entertaining value. But if you're reading it and you're going, is he making this stuff up? You know, where did he get that? I've got footnotes throughout all the novels, and it'll take you back. And I'm not saying I have citations of books. I literally have, I cut whole paragraphs explaining things from scholars and Bible scholars and Bible teachers that I respect to give the background for the fiction that I'm writing. And as it turns out, in my novels, I've got as much footnote text as the text in the novel itself. And so Christians who really want to, who want to go further and deeper, there's so much of that in my novels that you can just enjoy it on a surface level, and things will are explained to a certain degree through the storytelling, and I have scripture in the storytelling as well. But if you want to go deeper, I put those footnotes in there. And I did that because I knew my viewpoint was not a well-known viewpoint, because it's not the most popular viewpoint. It's not left behind. So people were going to read it and going to be shocked, some people, because it's like, I've never heard that before, you know? And so I just felt like I owed it to my audience to provide that for them.
Okay, let me ask you this. Let me jump in here again. Sure. Now, okay, so you talk about, I have several questions, okay, actually, and I want to try to get through these before the end of the interview. But let me ask you this, Brian. You talked about the prophecies and how it kind of changes, I guess, from year to year when people really kind of focus on what it's saying. Have you seen any of the prophecies spoken of in the Bible come true? And if so, can you explain those to us?
No. No, I mean, like, for instance, you know, I don't keep close track of all these, speculators, but, one of the big ones is John Hagee, you know, and I know he was Blood Moon Prophecies, you know, this is like 5, 6, 7 years ago. I don't even know how long it is now. I remember him. So the Blood Moons, if you look at, they're all lining up. And so something's going to happen within the next couple of years. Of course, he was hinting at the rapture and the Great Tribulation starting. Of course, it never did. You know, and so the blood moons just, it seemed like it was so prophetic, but it really wasn't, you know, and that was just an example of the kinds of things that I see failing all the time. But in terms of fulfillment, I believe, you know, most of these prophecies that are interpreted as being in our future actually were already fulfilled in the past. And that's why I'm writing the books I do. For instance, my book, End Times Bible Prophecy, that's more of a Bible research book. And why I wrote that was I wanted it to express my own journey and how what persuaded me, you know, because I used to believe the opposite. So I'm like, here's my journey and here's what happened to me and here's why I changed my mind. And I thought that I think that that's a very helpful personal way of approaching it rather than sort of banging people on the head with Bible verses or whatever. And so End Times Bible Prophecy has been able to help Christians to walk that journey, you know, with me and see the new paradigm, the new way of seeing these scriptures. So, heck, I've even look, the Book of Revelation, right? That's the that's the climactic end of the whole, you know, Bible, right? And of course, that one is so full of symbolism, and there's 100 views for 50 different scholars, right? So if we're honest, we have to admit that there is a lot of differing interpretations, and we have to be willing to listen to different views. And there's a lot of views within Orthodox Christianity. And my view, which many godly Bible scholars have actually communicated, I think Revelation really is mostly about that first century judgment on Jerusalem, and it uses significant spiritual terms. So a lot of what people assume, well, this stuff hasn't happened yet, I do think it's applied symbolically to that first century. And, you know, one of the ways that you can discover this on your own is there is one book written by an ancient Jewish author who lived through the destruction of the temple in AD 70. It actually was a war where the Jews rose up in AD 66 against the Romans because of their oppression, and it became a war where the Romans came in and invaded Israel, and they wiped it out, and then they also destroyed the temple and Jerusalem, right? And then they, murdered a million Jews and sent 100,000 of them into slavery. And it was one of the most significant historical and spiritual events in Jewish history. And yet so many Christians don't know much about it. Well, the ancient Jewish historian Josephus, Flavius Josephus, wrote an account, huge book about that. It's the only existing full story that we have of what happened in that time period. And he lived through it, literally. And if you read that, it's kind of boring. It can be dry history, unfortunately, at times, but it's very detailed. But my point is the devastation that he describes of what happened when Rome came in and just slaughtered the Jews and stuff, it reads like the Book of Revelation. He even sometimes uses the same language, like he'll say, you know, blood was running in the streets, that kind of a thing. And but you can see the devastation. It was so significant and serious that it starts to make sense of some of this extreme language, you know, which is symbolic in the Book of Revelation.
Do you believe the Bible's been tampered with?
What do you mean by tampered with?
Rewritten.
You mean by
rewritten.
Oh no. I mean, I believe in the standard evangelical, you know, view of the inspiration of Scripture, and you know, I don't.
And I'm asking you this naturally because, you know, we haven't lived forever that we know of.
Yeah.
You know, anything could have been done. You know what I'm saying? Before us. So do you believe at any point in time that someone, a church, rewrote it for their own purposes?
Not after Christ. No, but I do think that God providentially uses human authors and editors to compile the Bible. So in other words, the Bible wasn't just written and plopped, you know. I mean, it's gathered and edited over, you know, 1,000 years, you know. And so there is editing and such that was done. This is standard textual criticism that all, you know, Bible believing scholars will admit to, you know, and that is, as a whole, the Bible was definitely over time, it was, you know, put together over time. It wasn't just slapped out of the sky like the Muslims claim that the Quran is.
Mm. Oh, okay. But, so parts of it was slowly put together.
Yeah. But I believe providentially God guides that process. And so I don't believe that there's tampering in the sense of there's corruption or anything. I mean, there's textual variances and corruptions that we have, you know, numbers here and there that are different or changed, but there's no problem in the text that is significantly theological. You know what I'm saying? So there are literal scribal errors and stuff like that, right? So I don't know if you're getting at to some one of your own beliefs, but I just believe the standard, Christian.
The reason why I'm saying it is because I know that, people can be corrupted and do god-awful stuff to each other. And this is the most powerful book ever. And it's an influencer over millions of people, billions of people. Yeah. Why would they not be tempted to rewrite it?
Sure. For their own purposes? The only thing I would say about that is that it wasn't written. Most of it was not written from the seat of power. It was actually written from the seat of marginalization or unempowered people. So they, in other words, they weren't justifying power. That's for sure. In fact, the Christians were the ones being persecuted, while they're writing the Bible. That's why most of the Bible is addressing Christians, how to deal with persecution and stuff. But I would say this though, that, that where I might differ with some Christians is they tend to have this view of the Bible as if it's this sort of magical perfection given to us directly from God type of thing. And I don't see that. Like even I do think, for example, translations of the Bibles are also interpretations. And so there are poorly translated words and things in our English Bibles, in my opinion, depending on the version, that do affect theology. But that's man's translation. That's not necessarily the original text, if that makes sense. So we'll have words that are translated. You'll see in the old versions that it was like, it was really poorly translated. And some words, for instance, nowadays, like the word earth, that's a word that actually means land in the ancient context. And the Bible translators are often translate that word for land as earth. And what do we think of when we think of earth? We think of the globe, right? The whole globe. But that's not the context of what that word was actually meaning. So that's just one little example of how translation can affect the interpretation for the worse. And I do believe there's a lot of that has gone on. I don't think but I think that's more a problem of translation rather than the original, the original text, if that makes sense.
Got you. Okay. Now, you mentioned New World Order earlier. Mm-hmm. Is that something you've been looking at as well?
No, I'm not big into that stuff. Consider it this way. I'm a person who I believe that that there is not going to be a future rapture. There's not going to be a 7-year tribulation with an antichrist that makes, this left behind view. I don't believe that's going to happen in our future because those passages were misinterpreted by others. Then they apply to the past.
What there about was an antichrist? Do you believe that?
Well, that's a good, here's, okay. That will be a good case, a case point, that will illustrate what I'm saying. The word antichrist is a misinterpreted word by most Christians. They assume that the word antichrist is a individual who's like Satan incarnate or something like that. But it's this individual in our future who's going to sort of take over, and he's Satan incarnate roughly, okay? But if you go and find out where that term is used in the Bible, it's only used in the books of 1st and 2nd John. And the definition, John literally defines it, what Antichrist means, and it's not an individual. He says in 1 John 2:18, children, it's the last hour. He was writing that in the first century. He's saying it's the last hour. Everything's happening now. And as you heard that Antichrist is coming, so now many Antichrists have come. And what is the Antichrist? It is he who denies Jesus the Christ, he who denies the Father and the Son. That is the Antichrist. And so he was basically, it's like saying anti-Semites, like only it was against Christians. So in other words, the Jews of that day that the Christians were trying, Christianity began as a Jewish sect, right? And they were trying to reach out and preach the gospel to the Jews first before it goes to the Gentiles. And so if you read the context there is no individual called the Antichrist. It's only this spirit, not spirit, but it's this view that denies Jesus as the Christ. And who in that first century denied Jesus was the Christ? It was the apostate Jews who rejected Messiah. So he's basically saying that's Antichrist. Just like today, in today's world, we'll say something, well, that's anti-Semitic, or that's transphobe, or, you know what I'm saying? It's like the phobe language. You could, a better translation of that might be Christophobic, you know? But my point is that there's no indication of an individual Antichrist. There's only a description of anyone and anyone who rejects that Jesus is the Christ or, you know, is actually Antichrist. And so no, I don't think there's an individual Antichrist at all in the Bible. However, they link that with something that I do think exists in the book of Revelation. It talks about the beast, right? And I do think that there's a beast and one of its heads and represents a king and all that. It's sort of like you have to look at these things piece by piece, you know. So I do think there's a beast of Revelation. But there, if you interpret it, if you go and look at where it talks about that, which is I think Revelation 13, but
what do you mean by that? Nero. I'm sorry, but you mean a physical? It's a physical thing. What do you mean by beast? Can you go into detail with that a little bit?
Sure. So there's two beasts in Revelation. There's a sea beast and a land beast. In Revelation 13, it talks all about that. And this is you've heard the phrase, the mark of the beast, right? What's the beast? Well, the beast is a symbol because obviously in the book of Revelation, it talks about a dragon with seven heads. There are very few people who think that's literal. There are some who do, but most people don't. And they acknowledge that this is a symbol of some kind of New World Order or imperial power, et cetera. And getting the mark has to do with, you know, ownership, like you are owned by that monster. And what is that monster? Well, that's what everyone tries to interpret. And the view that I'm a part of, that believes Revelation was about the first century, fits very nicely and perfectly with Nero. Nero is the head of the beast, who is the king of that time, and how he was persecuting Christians and forcing them to worship him. And if they didn't, they would be, you know, cast into the lion's dens and stuff like that. So that's one way of interpreting the beast. That's my interpretation. Many people believe that, no, the beast is in our future, right? But we're all acknowledging that it's symbolic of some kind of imperial power. But I wanted to but I always have to tell my futuristic Christian friends, you know, who believe in this future stuff, just because I don't believe there's a mark of the beast in our future, or just because I don't believe there's some antichrist in our future, doesn't mean that I don't believe that there's tyrants who want to take over the world, because that's always been the case, right? And the point is that I do believe that there are evil people who are trying to control the world and whatever, call it the New World Order. I don't know. I don't study that much about it, but I know human nature and I know they're trying to take over the world. But that doesn't mean it's a fulfillment of prophecy. It's just a fulfillment of the evil, sinful nature that is in all of humanity. And so consequently, I fight against it just like any other Christian would. It's just that I don't think that there's a prophecy about it. That's all. It's just we should always be fighting tyranny and evil governments who seek to control our lives, you know.
All right, got it. And my last question is, can you tell us about some of the most well-known movies that you've worked on? I just want to see if we know any of those.
Well, I haven't. I'm not a well-known movie maker. I don't think I'm a bad one, but the one that I'm most proud of is To End All Wars. And like I said, that should be free on Amazon or YouTube right now. And it stars Kiefer Sutherland. It's a World War II true story about prisoners of war under the Japanese. And it's basically like a Chariots of Fire. It talks about how the power of God comes and changes these suffering men's lives. And it's a very beautiful, true story. And that one I really like. And, you know, I've done some other ones. I've done some documentaries and stuff that are harder to get. I have not had a prolific, career in that. I've worked on little projects here and there, more like independent films. So there are others, but I'm pushing people more towards my books nowadays, because that's where my storytelling has matured and offers both theological and entertaining storytelling, because I really I've always avoided Christian storytelling, you know, like Christian movies, Christian this, Christian that, because I think a lot of times Christians tend to devalue entertainment because they're so concerned about making sure that their message gets across, their, you know, that their theology gets across. And I think that that's a mistake. I think we have to hold both content and the form, the style, the, you know, the craft. They have to both be equally important. So I want to write very entertaining stories. If it's not entertaining, I won't write it. But I also incorporate my theology into them. So that's why Chronicles of the Apocalypse, Chronicles of the Nephilim, and actually my latest novel series is called Chronicles of the Watchers. And that also deals with similar stories, mostly all from the Bible, but it's sort of pulls back the curtain on the spiritual world and sort of tries to depict what it might look like from this perspective.
All right. And tell us about your website, Brian, and then where they can touch base with you on social media or keep up with anything else you're working on.
Oh, sure. Thanks. Yeah, it's basically my name, Godawa.com, GODAWA.com. And really everything's there at my website. I put a lot into it. I wanted to make it interesting and worthy. I've got a lot of free articles and research for people who want to go deeper into this stuff. You can find out about all my novels and what they're like and what the series is about. I have a bunch of pictures. I actually cast all my novels' characters because I love doing that. So just for fun. But, you know, everything I write is on Amazon in paperback, ebook and audiobook. And so, if you go straight to Amazon, quite frankly, you read the description of the books and the novels, or you find the series, you'll get everything you need to know whether or not this will be an interesting, you know, book for you to read. So I usually just tell people go straight to Amazon and look up my name. It's truly a unique name. No one else is going to have that. So Brian Godawa.
All right. Brian, many blessings to you. And I really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
To find out more about our guest and all others, please visit our website at mysteriousradio.com. And I want to give special thanks to our co-creator and executive producer, Kim Kyle, who brought this show to you today. And working hard behind the scenes, our team of four, I want to thank them as well. Follow us on social media and share the show with others that may like the subjects that we cover. I am your host, K-Town, and you're listening to Mysterious Radio.